In 1959, for the first time ever, a non-aristocrat became part of the Japanese imperial family when she married the crown prince. She's now the Empress of Japan, but in the half-century since, her personality has been concealed from the public by elaborate imperial conventions. A recent novel by John Burnham Schwartz, The Commoner, imagines the Empress's interior life, and it brought him to the show earlier this year. We are airing it again for you now. Readers of his earlier novel, Reservation Road, might be surprised that he wrote this one, too. So I started by asking John Burnham Schwartz, wasn't this his second novel to take place in Japan?
It is. My first novel, Bicycle Days, is also set there.
That was largely autobiographical, and that was about the trials and tribulations of a gaijin, a Westerner, in Japan.
Yes, and I had lived in Japan for almost 5 months when I was 21. I had been and majored in East Asian Studies at Harvard and was completely immersed in that world. And the beginning of that novel actually started as my thesis at Harvard. I had persuaded the department for the first time ever to let me write fiction for my thesis, and that ended up leading eventually, after much work, into my first novel, Bicycle Days.
Well, that was a far cry from a novel in the voice of a woman who marries the crown prince and later becomes the empress of Japan.
Well, from my perspective, American guy living in Brooklyn, almost anything would be a far cry from that.
What prompted you to start thinking about the private life of the Empress of Japan?
Well, you know, I did have this background in Japanese culture and history, and so...
And you speak Japanese?
I used to. I worked very, very hard, and over the years since then, after that first novel, I lived in Europe for a while. I've done other things, and my language skills, I was sorry to find when I went back 3 years ago, were very rusty indeed. But... I had always sort of kept an eye on what was going on over there. And, of course, Masako Owada, who is currently the crown princess, was 2 years ahead of me at Harvard, though I didn't know her. And so when she married the crown prince in 1993, I was quite aware of that. And I also was aware that she had already rejected him 3 times before accepting him. And that immediately, if you don't have to be a novelist to be interested in what might be going on behind that.
Perhaps she knew too much about what lay ahead.
She knew too much and not enough, I think it might be safe to say. But around the mid-90s, I have a great aunt who's almost 96 now and who was a legendary children's book publisher. And she published two volumes in the early 90s, two volumes of translations made by the Empress of a Japanese poet for children. The Empress was very pleased with these and eventually, through an intermediary, invited my aunt to come and have lunch at the palace. And it was my aunt's account of that lunch, the two of them just alone in a room for 2 hours, and the constant questioning of the Empress about my aunt's life, a life that was completely different. An independent American woman, married late, never had children, had an entirely professional career of her own well into her 80s, that my aunt's account. She came back and she said that it was almost as if the Empress were imaginatively investigating a life that, under completely different circumstances, might have been her own.
So that got you thinking about what would be behind that. But then you had to come up with a voice. And as I understand it, the royal family has a different approach to language. They actually have some unique verb conjugations.
Well, there's... I discovered this when I first really began looking into the emperor before the current one, Hirohito, who, of course, is known here largely for having presided, however distantly or not, over the war. The thing about Hirohito is that he spent the first part of his life not as a man but as a god. That's what he was considered. And so when he got on the radio in 1946 in January at MacArthur's directive, and he was forced to announce to his people that he was, in fact, not a god but a man. Had you been in Japan then, and I've spoken to a couple who were, you would have seen people all over Japan and some of them falling to their knees because, A, they had never heard his voice before, and B, many of them did not know that he even had a voice like a normal human being. And then as in the succeeding years, as he went out among the people, people discovered that he didn't even speak. He spoke this convoluted court Japanese and, in fact, did not know the names for many ordinary things. And the only, the thing to think about in considering how this connects with Empress Michiko, who married in 1959 at the age of 24, into this family is to say, well, what sort of family did this commoner enter? And what you're aware of is 13 years before she married, she who had had a normal childhood, just like anybody else.
Her father was the president of a flour milling
company. Yes, and she was quite privileged, no question about it. But she had friends and schools and family. 13 years before she married into this family, her father-in-law had been a god. Actually, in no way considered to be a normal human being.
So to some degree, this is really a history of post-war Japan as much as it is anything else, because you're really showing us a country that had to go through major changes in the way that it thought.
I tried very hard to make that a part of the landscape of the novel, and I think that more really in some odd way than The Voice, it was trying to trying to incorporate this history into the narrative that was a challenge for me, and that I really enjoyed doing, trying to show to what degree the landscape was a part of her life.
Well, the cliche of the Japanese is that they will not tolerate people deviating from the norm, although we constantly see it happening. Mm-hmm. But in the royal family, that is a problem, isn't it?
I think it's a real problem. I think it's one thing if you're born into that system. The emperor, the current emperor and crown prince were both born into that world. Strange as it is, full of limitations, as it no doubt is, that's one thing, but they're adjusted to it. But both the empress and the crown princess grew up outside of that. And the idea that they never knew that at a certain point they were going to cross the moat, which surrounds the 240-acre palace in the center of Tokyo, and literally at that moment, at some level, disappear. Have their narrative completely taken from them.
And you compare a commoner living in the Imperial Palace to someone who's fallen down a well.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's something that I sort of came to feel as time went on. It was, you don't actively think about this, but over time you have to create your own image, or an image is created for you about what is exactly is happening to your characters. And I pictured this incredible deep darkness where in which no story of one's own is allowed to persist or live.
Can these people do things that we take for granted, like make a telephone call or write a letter or take a walk?
Telephone calls are a relatively recent activity. And in fact, letters are written, but almost never without some awareness by someone. They can walk on the grounds. They can't certainly just walk out and about. They can't go to restaurants. It's so hard to imagine in this age of YouTube how little we will ever know about these people as human beings.
And the woman you write about, based on the real Empress, loses her voice at a certain point. And that really happened. And it almost seems like a literary metaphor.
I know. That's the thing. You have to be careful. There's that whole thing, it's too strange to make up. What we're dealing with, if you're researching this story, what you're dealing with is you're dealing with a few biographical facts. And since we will never know what they actually thought, because nothing will ever get out about this, no letters, no off-the-cuff remarks, we have that moment. She did lose her voice for almost 7 months.
How did we find out about that?
That eventually got out because first, as the seriousness of it sort of overtook the palace, they had to finally demand to the press that they start to leave her alone. It still was never fully, as none of this ever will be, ever fully reported in the mainstream press. It was really the foreign press that began to report on it.
And there have been rumors that the princess, the current princess, has had problems with mental illness. The suggestion is that this odd life, this closed-off life, will drive anybody crazy unless they're born into it.
I think it's since the birth of her one child with the crown prince in 2001, a girl, of course, not a boy, and the boy is what was needed and wanted.
Well, biology. That's his problem, not her problem.
Well, I mean, this also has not been raised much in Japan, as you can imagine.
There's pressure on her to produce a male heir.
Yes, and I mean, she's not going to. Finally, what happened was a year and a half ago, after, she's hardly been seen in public for over 4 years. She suffered one kind of collapse after another, and at the age of 44, her life in some way would seem to be almost over. And she had grown up all over the world speaking all of these languages, and this is what it's come to. There was a second brother, a character I left out of my novel because I sort of saw this coming and didn't really feel that it was the story that I really was writing about. But for whatever reasons, after saying that they would have no more children, he and his wife got pregnant again and finally gave birth to a boy a year and a half ago.
My guest is John Burnham Schwartz. He's written a fourth novel. This one is called The Commoner, and it is published by Doubleday in the Nantalese imprint. Can't writing about the Japanese imperial family be a risky business? Last year, the publisher of the Japanese edition of a biography by an Australian of the current princess consort had to drop the book, and then when a smaller publisher picked it up, he couldn't find any place to advertise it in.
Yeah, that's true. It was Ben Hills, an Australian journalist, who wrote a book about Masako. And in fact, you know, I would be very surprised if they ever published this book in Japan.
But but this is a work of imagination.
Right, but this is the thing. It's clearly a deeply sympathetic portrait, but it is a Western act of sympathy. It would not be done by a Japanese, and in fact, it has never been done by anybody in modern Japanese history. The only thing that was ever done in any way like this was that I'm aware of was in 1960. A then well-known Japanese writer published one short story in a little magazine. In which I think he meant it to be satirical. It may not have been that funny. The narrator has a dream, and in the dream, members of the imperial family are beheaded. So a few months later, the publisher of the magazine is out of his house, but the house is broken into by one of those ultra-right, ultra-nationalist fanatics who still are very much out there with a sword, and he kills the man's maid and grievously wounds his wife, and the publisher and the writer go into exile, and the writer never publishes again. I, of course, you know, the American view of this, sort of spurred on by one's publishers is you think, well, a little short sword in the chest might be good for sales, so, you know, get on out there. My wife doesn't really agree with that.
Well, have you gotten any feedback from Japan?
It's been very interesting, I have to say. I've been on the road now for about 5 weeks, and I've been starting to hear about stories of Japanese tourists coming by bookstores and in very low voices, as though ordering drugs under the counter, asking
this is
if
pornography.
Yes, exactly. Asking if this book about the imperial family is there, and buying the book and stuffing it in their bags. And then, about 10 days ago, through my agent, I was sent a request for an interview by one of the largest magazines in Japan, and that was very interesting because their message said was that people were starting to talk about this book. And they asked me a series of questions about my relation, you know, my thoughts about writing a novel about the imperial family.
Well, as you said, it is respectful and sympathetic. And one of the things that you pull off is you find a voice, which had to have been very difficult because you can't translate from Japanese to English. You have to come up with some kind of an approximation that also has to do with her personality and the kind of language they speak in the royal family.
It's clearly, I mean, it's obviously not a Japanese narrative. And, you know, you and I are both fans of Kawabata and great Japanese literature. It's a Western book, but it's also not clearly a Western book either. And thrilling challenges in a way for me with this book was to develop a narrative relationship and a tonal relationship with reticence. Because reticence, you could argue, is the great mode of expression in Japanese culture. It's what's left out. And again and again, as I was working on this book through all 7 drafts and over the years, I had to decide what she would be able to say, even with the idea that she was writing this privately.
Is there no royalty to draw upon? We've had 2 marriages now with commoners. I mean, these are both women of real accomplishment and intelligence, but they still are outside of the box in a tradition that goes back thousands of years, where they always found somebody who was appropriate.
Well, you know, the two, if you look over the long history of the imperial family and back to the, you know, they trace it back to the beginning of recorded time, of course, through the male line with God knows how many concubines along the way. There's the tale of Genji in the 11th century, the first novel ever written by Murasaki Shikibu.
A woman, in fact.
By a woman, of course. And then a few hundred years later in the 14th century, you have a book called The Confessions of Lady Nijo, which was just found about 60 years ago. And that is written by a woman who was a courtesan to a couple of emperors and ended her life in exile as a wandering nun, of all things, which I think would be, in fact, a fantastic future for the women who are actually in there now. And then you really don't, there are not many documents along the way. And as we've gotten into the 20th century, it seems to me that the walls have closed around them even tighter. And if you think about it, in this country, if anybody gets famous, you can guarantee that the next day somebody is going to publish some letter that they received from you, you know, 20 years ago. Nothing like this has ever happened in Japan, and it never will happen.
I asked you about Japanese reactions. What about the reactions of people who've read your previous books?
Mm-hmm.
Claire Marvel, then
yeah.
Reservation Road, which was a thriller. Many people have seen the movie, although I don't know whether you want to be held responsible for that. this is nothing like those.
It's very different. I'm for whatever reasons, I'm a writer who I like to write different books, although I have to say my next book is going to be picking up the story of Reservation Road 12 years later. I think that, I mean, you know, I try not to think too much about the themes of my work. I want to preserve a certain amount of mystery, but there are elements of deep loss that go on for each character in every single novel. And I would like to think that not only do you carry old readers with you, but as I'm finding right now, in fact, you gather new readers. And it is this idea, I think, truly of that, in fact, our own narratives are one of the great resources that we carry with us. It's what we live off of. And to have that stripped from you is a terrible deprivation.
I just spoke to an economist the other day who's an expert on Asia. He is an Asian, mm-hmm. and he said that Japan is unlike all the other Asian countries. Even the way they modernized was different than the mm-hmm. way the rest of the Asians mm-hmm. have modernized. Will Westerners ever be able to understand the Japanese? Because they look so much like us and are so different all at the same time.
It's I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, I certainly, you know, I began my adult life in Japan, believing in some way that I had found a place that would embrace me forever and allow me to live an entirely new existence. And of course, I found out that they would not have me. And when I went back,
no matter how much you tried,
no, and I was trying really hard, you know. And when I went back 3 years ago, it was interesting. I hadn't been back in 19 years. I went back to do research for this book, and my language had gotten rusty. I left my wife and baby at home, and actually my child wasn't even born yet, and on the way. And I went back, and it was an incredibly alienating experience. It wasn't pleasant at all. I remembered all sorts of dislocations. And the interesting thing is that I was reminded once again that the culture would not have me. And at the same time, it was that sense of alienation that was the great research from the trip, because I was writing about people who were deeply, deeply alienated within their own culture. And so in some weird way, it actually really helped me. But it made me think that, you know, it was not going to be first on my list for going back.
So the Japanese are not only tough on foreigners, they're tough on themselves.
I think it's a very tough place. I mean, there have been a number of studies and books lately, and this is an extreme condition, but it's not totally isolated. For instance, of children who, having been terribly bullied at school, retreat to their homes and into their rooms and do not leave their rooms or their homes for years at a time, and that this is somehow abetted by their parents. And there are so many aspects of being wounded within a society that won't have you.
Sounds like perfect preparation for becoming a member of the royal family. John Burnham Schwartz's latest book is The Commoner, which is published by the Nan A. Talese imprint of Doubleday. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.